For the next hour, we're going to do a tag team presentation here. We have two presenters that will talk to us about ATSC 3.0 and the TV Spectrum auction and repack. First of all, Jay Adrick is with us. Welcome back, Jay. Jay retired from Harris back in 2013, but he has since continued as a technology advisor with Gates Air and consults with other industry activities. Jay's consulting activities are focused on emergency alerting, the development of the new DTV standard, ATSC 3.0, and regulatory spectrum issues associated with the spectrum auction and repack. And then Wayne Luplow will do the second part of the presentation. And Wayne holds a BS EE from University of Wisconsin and an MSEE from the University of Pennsylvania. He has 53 years in this industry. He's currently with Zenith, and his responsibilities include the development and deployment of ATSC 3.0 and development of new business opportunities for Zenith and LG. Jay and Wayne, and I'll let you guys handle the tagging part of it.
Good. Thank you, Chuck. Good to be here. One of the questions that I keep hearing from broadcasters and the folks that are actually going to have to do the heavy lifting when the time comes is this really going to happen? So we've put together the very latest. I worked with my friends, my attorney at Wiley Ryan, and as of this past week, we have a pretty good timetable of where things stand. In August, the FCC issued the auction procedures public notice. They are this month going to be issuing to all eligible stations an opening bid price. Whether it's based on what we saw from the Green Hill report or not remains to be seen, but we'll find out here shortly. There will be also this month an auction application public notice that will give the guidelines on how to do the application if you're going to participate in the auction at one of the levels. The stations will have a time window for between October and December to file an application saying that they're going to participate in the reverse auctions. There will also at that point be a prohibition on communications related to the auctions that will go into effect. And there was just recently a detailed document that came out, I think it was last week, from the FCC on what those prohibitions are. So I would advise anyone, whether you're in the lowest job at the station or the station owner, that you need to be very much aware, because collusion and other charges could be placed if the wrong things are said and they result in certain things happening. So between January and March, the broadcasters will be able to make minor corrections and modifications to their applications. There will be a deadline for broadcasters that are registered for the reverse auction to make a final commitment. At that point, it's a binding commitment. There's no backing out. So if you say you're going to, for example, exit the business, that's you're bound to that commitment. That date is March 29th, 2016, already been announced. And some people believe it's the start of the auction. It isn't. It is merely the point in time which you are bound and committed if you so desire. So between April and May, the FCC will notify each station, each applicant that is qualified to bid, whether or not the station is qualified, but perhaps there's no initial commitment that was made, in which case they're going to ride with whatever repack brings them. The commitment could not be accommodated, and therefore the station will be designated for repack. So the FCC thanks you for saying you'll participate, but they really don't need you. And finally, the station is not needed and will be repacked. So it's expected that in that time frame there will be a clearing target announced. Now, we saw this morning in Jim's wireless mic presentation sort of a depiction of the band, but that that depiction was only one possible scenario. There are many different scenarios for clearing targets. The likely range is at the low end, 84 megahertz, and at the upper end, 126, but there are actually scenarios that go beyond and below those two levels, but those are the likely boundaries that will take place. So once they know what the participation will be from the reverse auction standpoint, they'll be able to say, okay, this is what we think we can clear based on those who will participate. So somewhere in the May timeframe, the reverse auction bidding rounds will commence, and it's expected that the entire reverse auction process will take about 1 month. As soon as the reverse auction process is completed, within actually 2 days of that point, they'll be able to commence the forward auction bidding process, which is where the people who will acquire the spectrum in 600 megahertz will put their bids in. And that process could be a 2 to 4 month process, again, commencing probably about the June timeframe. So once we've had the reverse auction and the forward auction, the FCC will take a look at what the expenses are and what the potential revenues are. And if the revenues are sufficient to satisfy what they call the final stage rule, which means that there's enough money to pay the broadcasters, there's enough money to fund the relocation fund, which is $1.75 billion, and pay for the overhead costs for the auction, then the FCC can declare that the auction is closed. If for some reason the forward auction doesn't yield enough revenue to cover all of those things, then they would go back with a new clearing target and start the process all over. That's probably unlikely, but at least it's built into the rules and the process in case it would happen. So assuming that, and by the way, you notice that there is no mention of anything going into the Treasury beyond that. Don't you all recall when the broadband plan came out, we were going to put $27 billion into the Treasury? Kind of unique that that's fallen by the wayside. Although I think Congress has probably already spent it. So anyway, the FCC, assuming we have a close to the auction, will announce the winning bidders. And the winning bidders actually on both sides. So then there will be a channel reassignment public notice. This is where the musical chairs begins. Everyone will find out that decided to remain in the broadcast business where their new assignment is. The FCC will commence shortly thereafter paying the winning bidders. This will be on a rolling basis. So as the money comes in, where are we? Oh, yeah, sorry about that. Yep, I think we got the zero and the one in the wrong place. Okay, thank you. All right, so the repack stations then will have to file a construction permit application, and at the same time they'll have to apply for the reimbursement process by filing a budget. And the budget's got to be substantiated in real estimates as opposed to, you know, coming up with a number on the top of your head. And the reason for that is the stations will be compensated ahead of time on a partial basis. We'll talk more about that. So the stations electing to channel share must file minor change applications at least 60 days prior to the date by which they must commence sharing. That'll take place in December. And station deadlines to build out CPs will range from February of 2017 through December of 2019. Now, that doesn't mean you've got a 3-year window to build, because the current plan is the commission is going to analyze the complexity of your move, and they'll say, well, Jerry, you've got 9 months to move, and Gary, your station, you've got 18 months to move, and someone else might have 36 months to move. So it's kind of a role of project management that the FCC intends to take on. Another example of a train wreck about to happen. So stations that relinquish their channels either entirely or go to channel sharing will have to end their broadcasts and turn in their licenses within 3 months of the payment point. So that's likely to be February of 2017. Although they may seek an additional 3 month extension if needed and cause can be provided. There'll be a filing window for displaced translators in August of 2017, and a deadline for repack expense finalization and true up will take place in September of 2019. So all repack stations are to be operating on new channels, and all broadcasts on pre-auction channels will end by December of 2019. Now, keep in mind these are estimates based on where we are today and based on the fact that nothing slows this train down and we don't have any major train wrecks along the way. So I mentioned the anti-collusion rule. So you can't talk about planned bid amount, strategy. This applies nationwide. So if you're in one market, you can't talk about what's going on in another market, not just your local market. The couple of exceptions deal with channel sharing agreements and when you have co-owned stations in the same market. And again, that kicks in likely at the December of this year. So there's a hierarchy in bid options for stations. If you're a UHF station, you can go off the air, you can move to low VHF or high VHF, or elect to remain in UHF but subject to repack. A high VHF station can go off the air, move to low, or remain in high, again, possibly subject to repack. And low VHF, your only option is to go off the air. The FCC defined repacking in their process, and it's basically reorganizing the band so that the auctioned off portion of the band becomes UHF wireless services. The band plan was specified in a public notice. So the clearing targets, again, are thought to be between 84 and 126. They originally talked about 120. 120 and 126 are really the same because they threw channel 37 in there, and 37 will remain a non-TV channel, but it will move from being administered by the Media Bureau to being administered by the Wireless Bureau. There will be a guard band that's created between wireless and TV services to avoid any channel 51 issues like we had in the last clearing of spectrum. There will be a wireless duplex gap of 11 megahertz, and it will be a fixed gap nationwide positioned so that wireless devices can be moved around, ported from market to market, and still be interoperable. And then there's likely to be, depending upon how many stations participate, something called impaired spectrum, where locally or regionally spectrum that is allocated for wireless purposes actually gets used by broadcasters because there's not enough remaining spectrum in the lower part of the UHF band, and we'll see some examples of that. The channel 37 spectrum gets bounded by at least 3 megahertz of guard band on either side to protect the radio astronomy and the medical telemetry and other uses that go on. So here's what the band plan scenarios look like. You'll notice the 11 megahertz guard band that or duplex gap that runs down through the series of spectrum charts there. You'll see some guard band ranges that go from 3 megahertz all the way up to 11 megahertz between TV and wireless channel assignments. And essentially what you're going to see is if it's 126 megahertz, the highest remaining TV channel is 29, with a 9 megahertz buffer between that and the downlink frequency for the A block. If it's 84 megahertz, we've got channel 36 is the lowest, and it is adjacent to the 37 block, and then on the upper side, a 3 megahertz guard band between that and the A downlink frequency. The wireless channels get repurposed into 5 megahertz blocks rather than the 6 that we have today. So how many stations are directly impacted? Well, if it's 84, it's 543 stations that exist today above that point that would be impacted. If it's 126, we're at 860 stations that are above 29 that would be impacted. These are direct impacts. Now, some of these obviously would be stations that would be in the auction and therefore be going away, but we also are going to have indirectly impacted. So I worked on a fairly major project for the NAB earlier this year, and we took the FCC's 100 simulations that were done on repacking from the prior year and went through and carefully studied and determined that the process that they used did not provide any optimization. I'll give you an example. New York City, they had the WNBC assignment moving off Empire, or at least moving from the current channel they're on Empire to a channel that's currently assigned out on Long Island. And they had WCBS moving to the channel that WNBC gave up. Well, it doesn't make any sense. You know, I told Jeff Birch at WCBS or at CBS stations, I said, fine, you just, you know, move your transport stream over to the other guy's transmitter. You're in good shape. The other guy's got all the pain. But in reality, that didn't make any sense. So what you do is you'd optimize the move so that it's the WCBS that gets the channel from Long Island, and you leave WNBC where they were. So we went through and determined and said there's somewhere in a range of between 10% and 25% optimization to the FCC's plan. Now, the FCC with no optimization, their plan for 126 megahertz left somewhere between 71 and 92 stations out of 1,675 across the nation that would not have to move in channels. So add to that the optimization process, and we get a range of 400 to 167 stations that would remain on channel, and the stations required to repack between 860 and 1,065 that will have to repack. And this, of course, already has the stations that they've assumed will participate in the auction pulled out. So that's kind of the range of numbers. Now, you would think, well, we're going to go for less spectrum. The problem isn't as bad, but actually it's the other way around. So if we go for 84 megahertz of spectrum, still working with the 1,675 UHF stations that are out there, unoptimized, first of all, eliminated, we'd have to take out between 222 and 249 stations. Unoptimized 92 to 132 were the numbers that came up in the FCC simulations. We optimized those to 433 to 262, and the stations required to repack go up to 1,020 to 1,164. So that's the size, the range, kind of the limits of what to expect. I mentioned impaired spectrum. Impaired spectrum is where we place a TV station into a 6 megahertz channel that spans either part of the duplex gap or part of the assigned spectrum for wireless in a given geographic area. And we end up with what's called inter-service interference. There's both DTV to wireless interference from the base station, or from the TV station to the base station and to the wireless devices. And then there's wireless interference, which is the wireless base station to DTV receivers, and then handheld devices to DTV receivers. Here are a couple of examples. In this case, we've got 126 megahertz clearing. We've got a station that we've placed on channel 30, and it spans over not only the guard band, but it impacts the A block downlink frequency on a close-in basis to the base station. Here's channel 43, which is in the spectrum, in the duplex gap, and it impacts not only the duplex gap, but also the A block and marginally the B block downlink. All this is all the reallocation, if you will, is based on something called TV study software, OET69, and that was finalized in June 30th of 2015. So the program is out there along with all of the criteria and data, and OET69 basically looks at the market, divides it up into blocks, and analyzes the existing coverage and the potential interference from reallocating stations. In this particular case, we see an example where we have a station that used to be on 21 goes away. We have a new station that was moved to 21 in a different area. So the area of interference between that and channel 20 changes. It has to be less than an impact of 0.5% on the population that is impacted. So one of the questions that I get frequently from station owners and the station management people is whether or not they should move from UHF to VHF. They're enticed by these big numbers that show up in the Green Hill report for the opening of the auction. And my response is pretty simple. First of all, how important is mobile in your future? With ATSC 3.0 coming along, as Jerry gave us a good picture, is probably not best suited for VHF. The limitations are really the size of the receiving antenna, which is well below the Wheeler's limit, if you will, on how an antenna can perform. And then the other is in-home reception. One of the things that the broadcasters are trying to improve is the ability to receive in-home without the rooftop antenna. And it's very well known that UHF penetration is far better than VHF penetration. And then to add to that, we have a very very much of a growing noise floor in the VHF bands that has made the carrier-to-noise issues significantly worse for in-home reception. Things like appliances with microprocessors and PCs and so forth that maybe fall under the Part 15 limits, but still generate noise that the receiver gets blocked by. If we look at the repack process, it really can be divided into three stages. It's the construction permit and budget application preparation phase. And then there's a construction permit and budget processing activity that goes on by the FCC and a third-party administrator yet to be named. And then there is a post-construction permit construction phase where the station does the actual work to move. So one of the jobs that I did for the NAB report was to look at all available industry resources. So if we compare where we were in the DTV transition from analog to DTV with where we are today, the number of RF consulting engineers is dramatically reduced from where we were before. Tower structural engineers, there are only about five firms that can do tall towers. And these are typically one to two engineers per firm. It's not like we're hiring a firm of 80 structural engineers that can go in and do multiple towers in a day or two. RF and antenna system component manufacturers. There are two primary manufacturers of slot array UHF antennas, both with very reduced workforce. To give you some idea, Dielectric, which was over 300 employees at its peak, today I think is at around 40 employees. So it's not where we were when the high demand for antennas was out there. Transmitter manufacturers, basically down to the three companies, three primary companies. Tower and rigging crews, there are 13 firms that are in operation today that are capable of doing tall towers, have the equipment, the skills, the knowledge that can rig and move antennas that are quite heavy. Transmission system installers, there are about 10 to 12 crews out there nationwide. The only thing I couldn't find a shortage of were communication attorneys. In the construction permit and budget preparation phase, we're looking at RF consulting engineers, tower structural engineers, the antenna and RF component manufacturers. I'm going to move quickly through this. This chart tells you what they would do in that phase. Transmitter manufacturers will be involved. The rigging crews will have to be involved because you're really preparing budgets from all of these folks, the transmission system installers, and finally the communication attorneys who will pull all this together into your application and do the filing. The post CP phase, the construction resource folks out there, again, pretty much the same people, but now they're actually performing the tasks that they have to do, and ultimately we end up filing an STA when we're ready to switch, and then a license amendment. So the FCC, before they ever looked at all the resources, made up their mind how long all this was going to take. And they said that it was from the close of the auction, we're going to do construction permits, all of these, without even knowing how many all of these were. We're going to do this in 3 months. And then they said, if you talk to Bill Lake, oh, we'll turn a construction permit application in a couple of days. Haven't seen that before. You'll have 36 months after that to build. And if you don't complete everything in the total of 39 months, and you're not ready to go to the new channel, simply just go off the air and get your work done, and when it's all done, let the commission know and you come back on the air. Sounds like a good business model to me. So, by the way, they said, we want to hurry this along, so we'll help project management manage it, and we'll look at the complexity of your move and tell you how much time we're going to allow you. So just because we said the overall process is 36 months or 39 months, that doesn't mean you have 39 months. So where are the industry resource capacity constraints? In order to figure out what it would really take to do this job, you have to look at what all the constraints are. So we spent about roughly 2 months interviewing virtually all of the companies in these categories. And let me back up. There we go. So if you, to rank order where the problems are in terms of capacity, it begins with tower and rigging crews. That is definitely a major problem. Then tower structural engineers, then antenna and RF component manufacturers, then RF consulting engineers, and RF system installers. These are all the critical resources that we don't have enough of that are going to limit what the possibilities are. So, we took the resources, built a Gantt chart, and said, what if it's 84 or what if it's 126 for a clearing target? How long is it likely to take to get the first phase done, which is the CP and budget application preparation phase? And we came up with 14 months minimum, 21 months maximum to complete what the FCC thinks can be done in 3 months. Then we took a look at the construction phase without having any idea of how long the commission would take to process. If you talk to the insiders, they're all saying, well, if we get a lot of extra resources, we might be able to get this done in a few months. But no commitment there. And the construction phase ran 6.5 to 9.5 years. And that's what the commission wants to have done in 36 months. So one of the other questions is, what happens if you're not repacked, but you're in a situation where you're stacked on a tower, or you share an antenna and transmission line and combiner in a multi-channel configuration, and the other station's forced to change, but you're not. But you incur expenses because you've got filters or you've got to have your antenna picked and moved. And again, there's no accommodation for that in the current compensation plan. So you should be working with the other station if that becomes the case. Will it affect radio? Well, we've found a number of cases where radio antennas share the towers with TV towers, TV antennas. And obviously, the riggers are not going to work at full power with your FM station blasting away in the same basic aperture area that the TV antenna is on. The folks at Empire told me the story about what they have to deal with. They'd have to move down to the standby antenna to let people work up above. And, oh, by the way, the standby antenna is right above the observation platform, which generates millions of dollars of revenue. So on Empire, they can only work between 1 in the morning and 5 in the morning on the antenna because they'd have to shut down the observation platform, and the building owners won't allow that. So paying for all this, $1.75 billion reimbursement fund. And that gets shared, by the way, with the cable and satellite guys, although I can't really imagine that they have much to do compared to what the broadcasters have to do. If you're a commercial station, you'll get 80% of the money up front. If you're a non-com, 90% up front. A true-up occurs 3 years down the pipe. So we did an analysis, and the question was, is 1.75 big enough? If you remember, there were some folks saying that $3 billion was the number. There were others saying $2 billion was the number. Well, we did this based on, again, 800 to 1,200 stations, and we came up with 1.98 at the low end and 2.94 at the high end to get the job done. So the answer is the fund isn't big enough, and we're not quite sure how or what will happen when the train hits the wall on this one. Reimbursement items are pretty well outlined here. This is from the Wydelity report, and there is a guide that the commission has put out. I'm going to skip over much of this because I want to get on to our next presentation, but this very quickly shows what is likely to have to change in a repack scenario. We've got a lot of bandit parts in the current transmitters due to PA module design and circulators. We've got filters in transmitters that have to be dealt with. We've got high power mask filters, most of which are not tunable. The newer ones are. Transmission line, if it's sectionalized line, will not work on certain frequencies because you get high VSWR generation due to where the joints fall, and in many cases the transmission line will also have to be changed out. Again, I'm going to go very quickly through this. There are a bunch of different types of IoT transmitters out there, and that's kind of technology at the end of life. You have to look at the cost of either retuning that transmitter or replacing it, and what has happened in terms of solid state efficiency, the cost of operation, heat loads, all sorts of things like that. Again, I'm going to quickly go through this. You can see the difference between a one-tube IoT versus a solid-state equivalent. Dealing with technologies that, for the most part, there aren't many engineers left that really know how to tune and replace and operate those types of transmitting systems. So let's get on with the key takeaways in the presentation. All stations are possible repack candidates. Even stations not required to change channels can be impacted. Staying on air during repack will most likely require a temporary transmission system. Converting from UHF to VHF will impose limitations. Channel sharing will also create limitations, although it's less with 3.0 than it is with 1.0 because of the greater payload capability and the more efficient encoding. Impaired spectrum, including wireless duplex gap, will likely create interference issues for broadcasters and the wireless operators, both against the impaired spectrum, by the way. The timeline is substantially inadequate for stations that are forced to repack, and the budget is inadequate. There will be a great deal of impact on FM radio operation due to the work on the tower. We heard earlier today about the wireless mic issues and about the fact that we'll be sharing some of these frequencies with unlicensed white space. And stations that are unable to be reimbursed for any pre-activity, by the way, due to federal laws on spending money that is not previously allocated. So we've had a number of customers say, well, what if I just went out and did all my tower surveys and I did all, you know, other things and then billed as part of the repack budget? And that is a no-no. That cannot be done. So if you do things in advance, you're doing it on your nickel, not on the government's nickel. And that wraps it up. I've got about 4 minutes for questions, and then we'll bring Wayne up here and we'll talk about ATSC testing.
Estimates of the repack, where there were between 180 to 400 stations, from stations eliminated, being from about 260 to 450.
Right.
And that's for eliminated from the UHF band? Or is that eliminated altogether?
That assumes that they are eliminated from the 1,675 UHF assignments that are full power in Class A.
Okay,
so they could move to VHF,
right,
or they could channel share, or they could go out of business.
So some percentage of those will be moving to VHF, but we don't know what that, we don't have an estimate on that percentage.
We won't know until the applications have been filed.
Okay.
Okay.
Jay, you did a great job explaining the realities that we're facing. In fact, you even touched on radio, which most people don't and they tend to ignore. So I just have to tell you that the one sort of the other elephant in the room now is the low power television stations, which of course you just mentioned, not full power, not, you know, Class A. And so for sure, those are just being decimated.
Well, the obviously, low power stations were ignored in the rulemaking process, and translators were ignored. However, there's been a lot of pressure on members of Congress, particularly over translators, because in the western part of the United States, they're very important for the distribution process. And the low power people provide a lot of the community access service to some small communities as well as large. It remains to be seen what will happen, but I think for the most part it's safe to say that they're going to either end up in VHF service, particularly in the larger, more crowded markets, and perhaps will shoehorn into in smaller markets that are far away from the dense markets into a new UHF assignment. It's just part of the reality of how things are going to get squeezed.
What about if they're going to stagger these stations making a change? What about the interference when somebody comes on the air on a different channel and somebody else hasn't gone off yet?
Yeah, that's one that the NAB has been wrestling with, and they've got some ideas on how this can be done on regional basis. They haven't really publicly announced how their what their concepts are, but they do have a plan that, by the way, also fits into how we do build out in 9.5 years as opposed to 36 months. The real question is whether or not the commission will listen to this. I kind of believe that the current administration at the commission will be gone before the train hits the wall, and it'll be somebody else's mess to clean up because they've been very stubborn about listening to reality. Again, this is based on firsthand being there and trying to reason with them, and just not making headway.
Okay, excellent presentation, Jay. Thank you very much. We get the transition to the next guy.
Well, thanks, Jay, and I want to start by thanking Jerry for telling you everything you need to know about 3.0 and everything that's going on there, so I don't have to spend much time on that, and we can be busily talking about the results of some field testing we've done with a system that is almost equal to the 3.0 physical layer system. It all started right here in Madison last year at the same time as your conference here. We used the fine facilities of WKOW. We did some field testing for fixed mode, indoor reception, and mobile reception. And of course, we did it in the middle of the night. We started out at WKOW, went to the Cole Center, and then a steel garage, and back here at the Marriott. How many of you were with us last year? Well, there was a few. I hope you found it an enjoyable night with us at that time. So we moved on from Madison and did some additional tests, actually more testing in Cleveland, Ohio. The good news there is we were able to obtain a dedicated channel that we could use during the daytime, 7 days a week, without having to force anybody off the air in the middle of the night. And we did this in two different segments, both in May and then back in July. So just to review, last year we started out at WKOW. Our boys were out in with our field test van in several nights before that, and actually that night as well. Then we moved over to the Cole Center, and you may recall a reception deep inside the Cole Center. The little tiny antenna that we used, and perhaps those of you there remember the one reporter picked up the antenna and moved it all around, and everything stayed rock solid. After that, we found a place on the outside of Madison, which was I call a steel garage, and it was a pretty interesting place for reception. I think those of you who were there tried their cell phones, no cell phone service, but very good, successful service in that steel garage with the mobile system, the almost 3.0 system. And then we ended up back here at the Marriott, and using that same channel with the other programs, we showed you what looked to be some pretty decent 4K material right here in the Marriott. So Jerry gave you the elevator pitch on 3.0 and the benefits. I'm going to give you the single story pitch on the benefits of 3.0. First of all, extremely robust mobile reception, the capability for Ultra HD, sometimes known as 4K, the capability for IP transport and the commonality with internet capabilities, so the convergence of broadband and broadcasting. Jerry talked about advanced emergency alerting, which we think is a major driver towards the successful adoption of 3.0, and a lot about the audio system and the immersive audio approach. And again, Jerry gave you a good overview on that. But for me and for our company, these are the five top things that broadcasters should be able to take away with from 3.0. So all of our field testing has been done particularly with the physical layer. Jerry talked about the other layers, but we aren't really concerned in our field testing operations about the other layers. We're concerned about how the signal is received under various conditions and under various types of signal transmission. The system is an OFDM-based system. It uses low-density parity code, intercoding. It's the common state-of-the-art type of coding for RF transmission these days. Various code rates are available. We used a couple of code rates. There's a thing called the guard interval, which has to do with the ability to reject other channels. We used a couple of examples for that. The system that we broadcast and tested was designed for what we call future-proofing. Jerry touched on that as well. The approach that we used with our system, which we called FutureCast, had a slightly different approach in terms of making sure that it was extensible into the future, but many of the teachings of our approach have been adopted into the 3.0 candidate standard that Jerry talked about. A bit of an eye chart. I just wanted to point out the technology that we used for our field testing here and in Cleveland. Much of it, all of that technology came from Zenith, LG, and Gates Air. And much of that technology has actually been adopted into the 3.0 system, the candidate system that exists. Today, there are two candidate standards relative to the physical layer. The first one was the one that's shown in the one block here that is the green elements. And all the other blocks came with the second candidate standard that was just approved here a couple weeks ago. The little box above the blue box shows where there is LG technology into those blocks. And so there is a lot of similarity between what the candidate standard says today and what we actually field tested. We don't claim to have everything that's in the final candidate standard, but the important thing to note is that there's a lot of similarities, so that the results that we had in our field testing can be quite well projected onto what will happen with 3.0 as that actually gets built out. So, OFDM modulation, as I said, one thing to notice is with the physical layer today, with 3.0 or the system we tested, there's a 36% increase in data delivery capacity compared to the 19.39 in VSB, our former system or the current system, and which now has been nicknamed ATSC 1.0. One of the important ingredients in the new system is the advanced video coding, HEVC, which gives roughly four times more capacity, or the equivalent capacity, compared to MPEG-2 that's used in the current DTV system. There are what we call multiple data pipes, and that allows you for, in any given 6 megahertz transmission, to have different types of services. You can have a 4K pipe, you can have a extremely robust pipe, you could even put radio channels in, all in different pipes, and there's trade-offs between robustness and data carrying capacity. Jerry had a similar chart, the well-known Shannon efficiency here, but I put on this chart an indication of where we are today and where we will be going. The two little green dots, one is the A53, the current standard, and you could see that there's an increase in data handling capacity associated with that, the data that can actually be delivered. The other little green dot is the A153. That's the current mobile system. I say current, that was kind of rolled out, the dial system. And for the most part, that system has not become commercially effective. But at the same time, it gives you an indication of where we are, or where we will be with 3.0 compared to the current mobile and fixed positions. So some of the features we had, and I've touched on this before, multiple pipes with varying trade-offs between robustness and data carrying capability. We have what we call a fast information channel for quick channel change so that there's not a big delay when you change channels, change programs on a given channel, or when you change from channel A to channel B. Emergency alerting capability, we've talked about that before, and I think I'll move on to the next slide. We started our work not by just running out into the field with hardware. We started our work with simulations, computer simulations of how the system should perform. And coming out of the simulations, we learned some things, and those things were corrected before we actually built hardware. The hardware that was built and used in the field test, built by LG and Zenith and Gates Air, all FPGA hardware, typically a small rack for both a receiver or an exciter part. When we started doing this, we identified some implementation loss in the receivers, and so before we actually put it into the ether, tested it here in Madison, we actually had to fix, if you like, the FPGA to gain about a 1 dB of loss that was in the initial hardware. And that got fixed before we actually went to the field testing. The testing that we did here was three simultaneous data pipes, or three simultaneous data streams, each providing three different types of programs with three different types of programs with three different capabilities in terms of robustness and data capacity. The first one, which is very equivalent, we call it DP0, very equivalent to ATSC 1.0, but with a 36% higher data capacity. The second one, we picked a rate which was equivalent to the quarter rate code that was used for most transmissions in the mobile DTV or the mobile H quarter rate code, so we could make a direct comparison. And we did test the backwards compatible mobile system in the same time frame that we did the field testing on the new 3.0 system. And then we did a really robust system for the idea of very deep indoor reception, like that garage that I showed you where we had excellent reception. So what did we do in Madison? We had several different routes that we took, over 16,000 data points for each mode on from those routes. The mobile performance was poor with the system that was set up to be equal to ATSC 1.0. But that's what we expected. 1.0 was not designed for mobile. And the base, roughly 15 dB signal to noise system for 3.0 have about the same capability, but not for mobile. So that was not a surprise for us. Because we chose a rate for the mobile handheld system, which was equivalent to the DP1, and DP1 was chosen to that, the performance there was comparable, and I'll show you some results shortly. This is a map of the routes that we took in Madison. Our big red dot, the WKOW transmitter, just right over the hill here. So here's our results from Madison. For reference, and on the right side of the chart here, you see the mobile handheld results. And the three bars on the left are from the new system. Now, green means 100% great reception, positive reception. Red means no reception, and yellow is kind of intermittent reception. And so what do we learn out of this? Well, for DP0, in a mobile environment, as I said before, the reception was not very good. It's what was expected. For DP1, that was the mobile handheld, that was compared to the mobile handheld quarter rate. And by looking at the chart on the far right, you could see that it was approximately the same. The more rugged system, DP2, had what appears to be about the same reception, but we found out in the process of doing this that the errors in our error recording system were overreported. And we fixed that, and I'll show you some data going forward which will show you how that really turns out. So, what did we learn out of Madison? There was an error reporting issue that we fixed and identified, and that the very robust system, DP2, the performance was much improved, and we learned that there was even further improvement that we could do with the preamble. So we did that change with the preamble before we moved our testing facilities to Cleveland later in the year. So, in Madison, we had a short window in the middle of the nights to do the testing. In Cleveland, we had full daylight and evening hours. We chose to use mostly daylight hours and let the guys sleep at night. Not quite a little different than we had here. And the way we did routes there is we would do a route in one direction with the transmitter in the mode of the futurecast or the 3.0 modes, and then turn around, do the route the other direction, and had the transmitter changed back to 1.0 with the mobile DTV signal included in that. So that way we had that comparison that I showed on the charts for Madison, and I'll show you on the charts for Cleveland. So in Cleveland, we did several routes. We had more time in Cleveland to do it. I'll show you a map where we did it. Lots of data was taken on that. And the performance improvement because of that preamble fix with the DP2 signal was verified with the actual field testing. So perhaps not too many people know a lot about Cleveland. It's along the lake, which has some interesting effects, by the way. Ducting, I think, is perhaps you know. The radials here were done first, and the one that looks like in the boonies, and we went back and did that because many of the data points along the radials weren't really very challenging. So, here's the Cleveland reception, our first approach there, which was done in May. And again, for reference, the DP0, which has a 15 dB signal-to-noise threshold, mobile reception, not very good, again, as we expected. The DP1, compared to the MH, the 1.0 system, came out very, very similar. But again, we had much better reception with the DP2, the most robust version that we chose to use in the testing program. For fringe area. We found out with the radials, as I said, that there's just not that many places where it was really challenging. So we went out to the fringe and did that kind of loop way around the outside. So it would really show up the differences of what you could expect in terms of receivability with the more robust system. So here you could see that DP2 being more robust compared to the mobile handheld or to the less robust versions of the FutureCast system came out a lot better in that fringe area. I want to talk a little bit about fixed reception and the threshold. We all know that the nominal signal-to-noise capability with 1.0 and the base system for 3.0 is in the area of 15 to 16 dB. Well, when you add in the real-world kind of considerations, you could see that VSB, which is the 1.0 system and the DPO, had very similar thresholds, close to about 20 dB. But for the more robust DP1 and DP2 of the new system, as well as the mobile system, the thresholds are a lot lower, as one would expect. So kind of summarizing that fixed reception thing a little bit, similar thresholds between DP0 and VSB, which is also called 1.0. DP1 and MH at similar thresholds had similar performance. But with the new system, the data capability of delivering at the similar threshold is approximately 3 times greater with the DP1 than the mobile handheld. So that's the better system associated with the new 3.0 compared to 1.0, which the mobile part was kind of a bolt-on. Whereas, you know, 3.0 is a brand new system and does not have the necessity of backwards compatibility. Now, that's a plus and minus, of course, in the backwards compatibility, but a long time ago, ATSC made the decision that backwards compatibility should not be something that would hold back the best capability that would be possible with the new system. So, in Cleveland, I mentioned basement reception, and where no 1.0 signal could be even found, or there was no reception either on a TV set, nothing could be found on a spectrum analyzer. Cell phone operation, those of us that were there, iffy, I think that's pretty close to zero, but some people had some reception depending upon the carrier. This is a photo in the basement of the facility that that we used, and what our colleague Tim is showing here is, yes, we did have reception in a steel basement underground with the most robust part, the most robust data pipe of the FutureCast system. So let me try and summarize a little bit what we learned out of the field test. First of all, doing the simulations and then building the FPGAs provided a lot of opportunity for us to learn what we had to do in terms of receivers and how we had to build the exciters. We had 3 simultaneous modes. The first one that I've said before, we call it DP0, similar threshold to VSB, but with improved data capacity. DP1, which was chosen to have the same approximate threshold as the quarter rate mobile handheld, and that's the quarter rate is what most people who implemented the mobile handheld system used, but it had 2.5 times more efficiency at that same threshold. And the truly deeper indoor mode far outperformed anything that we were able to achieve with the original mobile handheld backwards compatible system. So to sum up a little bit here, the test that we did with the proprietary Zenith LG Gates Air system called FutureCast verifies the performance and the technologies that are currently in the candidate standard of 3.0 and helped to us to learn with various things that we did on the field testing. Nothing like putting things into the real world to find out really how they work. The increased capacity over VSB, which is ATSC 1.0, was similarly confirmed in terms of data throughput. Remember the Shannon chart that I showed you earlier. Much lower signal-to-noise thresholds are available with the 3.0 system than are available with the mobile handheld backwards compatible system. And direct comparison with 1.0 demonstrated the performance is primarily dependent on the white noise threshold. And the fact that we now have a new system, we came away with the idea, with the fact that there is no deterioration in terms of basic coverage area. Nobody loses anything with respect to the new system. Now, as Jay points out, depending how repack goes, there could be slight changes associated with it, but it's not the ATSC 3.0 system that would be the result of that. So we demonstrated the capability of what you can expect with 3.0 when it finally gets completed and actually deployed. Same coverage for the same threshold for the basic system. Usable thresholds well below the mobile handheld performance that was achieved when people were testing the mobile handheld system. More mode flexibility, lots of modes for fixed reception, for mobile and for handheld, and as Jerry points out, it's a trade-off. Broadcasters have the capability to have multiple programs and make choices between robustness and data capacity. And this is a great indication that the 3.0 system, when it actually gets built and deployed, one can expect that the promises or the talk from people who have been doing paper studies and simulations are actually going to perform in the real world. So let me say thank you, and I don't know how we're going to handle the Q&A here, but maybe Len has an idea.
We can take questions. We don't want speeches because we're way over time. Is that okay? You got a question?
Well, since we're talking about physical layer, we're talking about RF devices, transmitters. Having not the sufficient industry rank to have been invited to Cleveland, I was very curious to know what physical, I understand that was a mothball channel 31 Comark system that Fox put on the air and now is Tribune owned. Correct?
Yes, it's a three-tube
Comark.
Three-tube DCX. Comark IoT.
DCX,
it originally ran at 600 kilowatts output, and we were able to get, without appropriate compression and so forth, about 400 kilowatts out of the transmitter.
And what other modifications, other than an exciter swap and reducing the power TPO, did you need to do?
We had to do some pretty extensive changes in the driver stages. The Comark drivers are very marginal. Went through, they had a lot of compression problems.
Uh-huh.
So we bypassed the drivers and drove the tubes directly.
Oh, okay. So you didn't use the Comark driver chain?
No.
And how about mask filter? Did you have to tweak
that
or
anything? We used the existing mask filter, yes.
Without any tuning?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the RF emission mask is the same.
Just curious, as far as transmitter power to reach equivalent coverage of ATSC-1, do you require similar power for ATSC 3.0 to reach where your equivalent coverage of ATSC-1?
Well, equivalent coverage, yes. The answer to that is yes. Obviously, with the lower threshold of visibility on some of the modes of operation, you're going to get greater penetration within the noise limited coverage area, or maybe a slight extension of the coverage area. We've been recommending, particularly where stations are going to go through a repack and buy a new transmitter, that you think about at least a dB of headroom in the transmitter for ATSC power. 2 would be ideal. We did employ some adaptive correction in the testing. It's the adaptive correction that we had written for DVB-T2, and it's, let's say, maybe 90%. It's not 100% effective. It'd have to be optimized ultimately for 3.0. But as you can see, the transmitter wouldn't perform at what it would normally do for VSB. So there is definitely the need for higher peak to average ratios in the transmitter.
All right, thank you, Wayne and Jay.
Len, if I may, and as long as I still have the mic, I wonder if, since you're in the applause mode, you would join me in wishing my friend and colleague Jay Adrick happy birthday. Today is his birthday. We won't ask him how many.
Thirty-nine.